Oh, nice. Then you should do it. And then no matter what you do. There's only a week left, I think.
Okay, first thing is, did you all get the emails that I sent? The one about the course evaluations? You know, it's a new system this year. Everything is done out online. And the other email was to let you know about the prompt for the take-home part of the final exam. You have to, when you go to the course website, you have to log in. It's in the private directory, so you won't even see the link to it on the home page of the course website. So be sure you log in to see the what the prompt is. Did anyone have a chance to kind of read the prompt yet, or any questions? Should be straightforward. The whole idea is to kind of distill off what you've learned in the course of this quarter. That's of policy relevance. That what have you learned that gives you insight into this basic issue of how policy should be conducted? Okay, so that's the basic idea of the class, and it's not just spouting off your own personal views. You're expected to back up what you say with references to the historical record that we covered in the course, okay? So it should be fairly straightforward. It's okay to kind of talk with other people in the class when you're writing, as long as the final writing is your own. It's just a chance for you to kind of pull things together yourself, all right? And so that'll be due in my office on Wednesday of finals week at 5 o'clock on the Wednesday of finals week. Okay. Yeah.
Do you want it formatted MLA style?
Or do you prefer it? No, it's formatted as though it were a memorandum. You're writing a memorandum to the President of the United States, right? You don't have to have footnotes or anything like that. You wouldn't have that in a memorandum. It's equivalent to like just a essay question in a final exam, but you know, do it memorandum style if you like. Yeah. Was there another hand? I thought I saw another. Yeah.
If you want to turn it in early, can we just turn it in under your door?
Yes, you can. Not just that, but if for some reason you have to leave before that Wednesday, you want to work on it at home or something like that, and in those cases, you can send it to me as an email attachment. I'll just have to print it out, but if you want to do it that way. And if you send it to me via email, make sure that you get a return email from me saying that I received it, because, what can I say, 95% of the time, emails are okay, but there's like 5% of the time people send you emails and you don't get them, and it's I don't quite understand how it happens, but to be on the safe side, you want to receive a return email. Anything else? Yeah.
Is there like a page limit or?
Did I say anything in the? Yeah. It's listed there. Anything else? Okay. Where are we in this course? The lecture on Wednesday covered an important phase in the history of the Cold War, kind of the watershed phase. Before 1963, the Cold War was a very serious conflict. People who lived through it thought at times there was a very good chance that this thing might culminate in a general thermonuclear war. After 1963, the Cold War lost its apocalyptic edge. The threat of a general nuclear war receded, never disappeared entirely, but it had a kind of theoretical quality. Yes, in principle, this is something that might happen, but no one really expected it to happen in their lifetime. Important change. Why did it come about? Because of the shift in the military balance? No. The shift in the military balance, the loss of American nuclear superiority, the coming of a world of nuclear parity, which we can date very precisely, mid-1963, Kennedy was briefed that the United States no longer had nuclear superiority in September of 1963, end of the Kennedy period, practically. You would have expected that, everything else being equal, to have led to an increase in tension, to the Soviets becoming more aggressive, because they were stronger. There was less the United States could do. The Americans would become less willing to resort to nuclear escalation to protect Europe. Right? But it doesn't have that effect. And in fact, Soviet policy shifts. You no longer have the aggressiveness of the Khrushchev period. You no longer have crises around Berlin or elsewhere. Soviet policy on these core political issues becomes quite mild. The main Soviet goal is to consolidate the status quo, to maintain the status quo in Europe. On third world issues, the Soviets are quite mild. They do not have the means or really any particular interest in intervening in a massive way in the third world. Even in the case of the Vietnam War, where the Americans are fighting a communist ally of theirs, the communist North Vietnam, the Soviets provide substantial material support to the Vietnamese, but no talk of, Soviet direct military intervention there. And in a whole variety of places around the world, you find a rather cautious Soviet policy, status quo oriented, in effect. Okay? It seems that a stable system had come into being by 1963. And not so long ago, before I started working on the 63 to 75 period, I would have basically said this was the end of the story. I would have kind of structured this course so that this was the last lecture today, pretty much. Last substantive lecture. Because, this is our story. This story of the Cold War, how we frame it. There's this core problem that lies at the heart of the Cold War, the question of German power. How are you going to defend Western Europe if Germany's kept weak and so on? Germany, how much of a free hand the Western Allies will have to do whatever they want with West Germany, how free will they be to give Germany more sovereignty, more independence, more power, allow West Germany to build up her power, especially in the nuclear sphere. That problem was so important because it was this one great exception to this fundamental rule about how the two sides could get along. Each would, control things in their half of Europe. And so we looked at these various points in the history of the post-World War II period when it seemed that an understanding on that issue was within reach. 1945, the kind of understanding that Burns and Stalin had reached Potsdam. 1949, the formal division of Europe into spheres of influence. Establishment of the two German states, creation of NATO. 1949, that was. Then 1954, the system established by the Paris Accords. None of these things worked. 45 is followed by, the outbreak of the Cold War in 1946. The two sides kind of screaming at each other, focused on the German question, by the way. 49 business is followed by the great crisis of 50-51. But it really did seem that a Third World War was just a question of time. Paris Accords business in 54 was followed just a few years later by the opening of the Great Berlin Crisis in November of 58, which culminated in the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. And it's finally, only during the Kennedy period, that you, that are, in 1963, that a set of understandings emerges that provides a more or less permanent basis for how the two sides could get along, right? But is it a stable system? As I say, just a few years ago, I would have answered that question, yes, it's fairly stable. I think it's still very important what happened in 63, but less stable than I thought. So that's what I'm going to basically be talking about a lot today. The structure of 1963. What is the heart of the set of political understandings? Not a formal treaty. The closest it came to having any formal, tangible substance was the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, Treaty of Moscow of July 1963. What's the importance of the Test Ban Treaty? It's essentially a non-proliferation measure. It's directed above all at two countries, the Federal Republic of Germany and the People's Republic of China. Okay. And and the whole idea is, if you could establish an international norm that prevents countries from testing or provides an umbrella under which America and Russia can take action either separately or jointly against countries that do test, then you can keep the lid on the spread of nuclear weapons. You could, and above all, you could keep Germany and China from going nuclear. Right. The whole idea is, if you can't test, you can't build. Testing is of fundamental importance in the construction of a nuclear arsenal. Right. So the Americans had hoped to kind of reach an understanding with the Soviets. Yes, we'll keep Germany non-nuclear, and what are we going to get in exchange? Well, we want you to kind of go along with a policy whereby we will keep China non-nuclear. And the Americans contemplated, under Kennedy, this is an important point, they contemplated taking military action to destroy the Chinese nuclear facilities at Lopnor in western China, and to do what was necessary either on their own or with Taiwan or indeed with the Soviets themselves to keep China from becoming a nuclear power and developing a nuclear capability, because this is the China of Mao Zedong. This is a very revolutionary China. The fear was that once China developed a nuclear capability, then she would pursue an extremely aggressive policy abroad and so on. And these ideas were actually broached to the Soviets during the Harriman mission. Harriman was a very important American figure in that period who was the head of the mission that was sent to Moscow to negotiate the Test Ban Treaty. The Test Ban Treaty isn't just about preventing nuclear tests in the atmosphere because of all the poisons that would be thrown into the air if you did test. Its importance is essentially political. Well, I'll come back to this point. So they broached the whole issue to the Soviets of, will you give us the green light for taking military action against the Chinese nuclear facilities? The Soviets, of course, by this point are involved in a very sharp conflict with communist China. Sino-Soviet conflict had developed during the course of the Eisenhower period. I should talk a little bit about that because it's actually kind of an interesting part of this story. It used to be the case that people, especially in the academic world, liberals in general, they would sneer at the Eisenhower policy, especially the Eisenhower policy toward China. It was like infantile, they thought. It's like this whole notion that the communist world formed a single monolithic block. You know, Russia and China were two separate countries, each with their own interests. China was by no means a Soviet satellite. Wouldn't it make more sense to not use that kind of rhetoric, this highly ideological rhetoric about the Sino-Soviet bloc? And have a more differentiated strategy that will allow us to drive the wedge between Russia and China. That was the standard critique of the Eisenhower policy. In fact, we know now, since the archives were opened up, that that was not the real thinking of the Eisenhower policy, Eisenhower and Dulles at all. The whole point of taking a hard line and using that kind of rhetoric and talking about a Sino-Soviet bloc was that it would drive Russia and China apart. And Dulles was quite explicit about this. He met with the there's this big Western Summit conference between Eisenhower and Dulles and their British and French counterparts at Bermuda in December of 1953. Dulles lays it out for them. Say, you know, we know from all the internal American records that they didn't think China was a Soviet satellite by any means. They knew that there were differences between these two countries. How could you drive them apart? By being nice to China? Dulles said, no. You want to take a tough line toward China. And how is this supposed to work? A tough line toward China? Well, anything that increased the risk of a general war, of an actual armed conflict between China and the Soviet Union would have major political effects, especially in this era of American strategic superiority. Because if we got involved in a war with China and we were talking as though we actually believed that China and Russia were a solid bloc, then it would be very natural for us to attack not just China but Russia as well, and to attack Russia as well before Russia had a chance to deploy her forces and attack us. So a risk of a U.S.-China war, given this rhetoric, necessarily implied that there was a real risk of a U.S. attack on the Soviet Union itself. And in such circumstances, the Soviets would want to disengage, right? Either by pulling the Chinese back and getting the Chinese to pursue a more moderate policy vis-a-vis the U.S., or by distancing themselves from the Chinese, saying, "Well, you know, we're not responsible for their policy. We're not, you know, we won't come to their aid. So you don't have to attack us, right?" Either of those two things would have the effect of driving the wedge between Russia and China. I mean, this is not a stupid policy. My old teacher Raymond Sontag, I remember him telling the Berkeley students and. This was like 1963, I think. He said to the students, "You may not like Dulles." You know, Secretary of State Dulles was very severe countenance and so on. He said, "You may not like Dulles, but remember this. You don't get to be just about the best paid lawyer on Wall Street by being stupid." Right? And, you know, Berkeley students in the 60s, we didn't understand what he meant by that at all. When I taught at the University of Pennsylvania, the Penn students didn't have any trouble understanding, you know, that what was implied there. You know, you have to be very smart to make it to the top of the New York legal profession. And so this was not a stupid strategy by any means, and it had the desired effect. Russia and China, in the course of the Eisenhower period, moved from being close allies at the beginning of the period to virtual enemies at the end of the period. And these nuclear issues loomed very large in the Sino-Soviet schism. You just look at the rhetoric. The fact that the Soviets withdrew their nuclear assistance from China in the late 50s. All right. So you have the Sino-Soviet schism that develops in the course of the Eisenhower period and is very obvious, very public during the Kennedy period. And this holds open the possibility that maybe America and Russia could work together. We had a common interest in emasculating China, preventing China from becoming a truly independent great power with a nuclear force under her own control. Now, the interesting thing is that the Soviets said no when this issue was put to them by Harriman in the meetings in July of 1963, in connection with the Test Ban Treaty. By the end of the decade, each shoe was on the other foot. By the end of the decade, 1969, it's the Soviets that want to take preemptive action against the Chinese nuclear facilities and destroy them. And it's the Americans who veto that during the Nixon period. Kind of an interesting part of the story. But for our present purposes, the important thing to note is in these talks in Moscow, in these U.S.-Soviet talks in 1963, after the Cuban Missile Crisis had revealed what the true structure of power is and the true nature of each side's interests were, after it had shown that the Khrushchev policy of threatening the West was actually bankrupt, okay. In these U.S.-Soviet talks in 1963, the Americans try and work out a kind of global bargain where, yeah, we'll keep Germany non-nuclear, meaning of the test ban. We'll force the Germans to sign, and if they sign the test ban, they can't build, right? And you, for your part, will deliver with the Chinese, or at least you'll green light what we want to do with the Chinese. But the Soviets say, no, they're not going to go along with that. So China does not enter into the terms of the bargain. It's focused on Europe. So if we're not getting what we want vis-a-vis China, what will we be getting from the Soviets in exchange for our promise to keep West Germany non-nuclear? And the answer there is certainly the very least we have a right to expect from them is their agreement to lay off on Berlin. They had been threatening Berlin for the previous 4 years. Now we say, if you want us to kind of buy into this sort of settlement that will stabilize the international order in Europe, a settlement of everyone respecting the status quo, including the status quo of a non-nuclear West Germany, then you got to give us something in exchange. What you got to give us is you got to respect our rights in Berlin. You can't threaten to kick us out of there. You know, you have to respect us as a great power, as your equal. Right? So the Berlin thing becomes, it's all along, it's been a central part of these negotiations. And a set of understandings linking Berlin with the German nuclear question lies at the heart of all of these arrangements. What are these understandings? How is Berlin related to the whole question of a nuclear Germany? Actually, in all kinds of ways. Why is it that West Germany can't build a nuclear force? Because she's held back by this kind of mortgage posed by Berlin. If she does, she moves in that direction, knowing how strongly the Soviets feel about it. She's putting the freedom of 2 million of her compatriots in West Berlin at risk. This would be an act that the Soviets would view as provocative. Their natural response would be around Berlin. So if you care at all about your fellow citizens or compatriots, I should say, they weren't actually citizens of the Federal Republic, in Berlin, then you shouldn't go nuclear. Plus, if you wanted to kind of deter the Soviets from doing things you don't like, you had to hold something in reserve that you could threaten them with. You could say, if you move against Berlin, then we will go nuclear. And that would tend to deter them from moving into Berlin. But to maintain that, you know, that threat, you had to stay non-nuclear to begin with, because if you developed a nuclear force, you couldn't then get any political mileage about threatening to go nuclear. right? There are all these kinds of things. The Soviet side as well, you know. Why should they give away, respect the status quo around Berlin as part of a package settlement? Because they would want to maintain the threat value of moving into Berlin if West Germany went nuclear. So these things are kind of connected in all sorts of ways.
Couldn't you argue that with the construction of the Berlin Wall, they already kind of accepted Western presence in Berlin?
Well, you would have thought so. But then the Berlin Wall did not put an end to the Berlin crisis, in large part because the U.S. government misinterpreted the Berlin Wall. I mean, to me, this is one of the most extraordinary parts of the story, because the Berlin Wall so obviously symbolizes the division of Berlin, the division of Germany, the division of Europe. You build a wall, you're basically accepting the status quo of a divided city, a divided country, a divided continent. But the American government did not interpret it that way. This is a problem with the way they viewed these things. They said, well, this is a first unilateral act, and it foreshadows additional unilateral acts, and it means the Soviets are not serious about ending the crisis. It means we have to kind of fall over ourselves, making concessions and so on. It's interesting to contemplate how events would have run their course if the Americans had interpreted the Berlin Wall the way you suggest and the way I think is proper. Who knows? Anyway, they have these negotiations in Moscow in July of 1963. The top of the iceberg is the nuclear test ban treaty, but there's all this other stuff below the surface. Yeah.
Do we have any records from the Soviet archives basically saying that when they built the Berlin Wall, they wanted peace and that they wanted, they acknowledge our presence as
a Well, not so much directly. There's a woman named Hope Harrison that studied these issues on the basis of both the East German and the Soviet archives. You can infer that point because the East Germans, prior to that point, for a number of years, had been lobbying the Soviets, let's seal the border, let's cut off the border, we can't deal with this whole refugee flow. And the Soviets answer them, no, we don't want to do that, because we want to keep this issue alive, because essentially we have bigger fish to fry. We're concerned with West Germany, and for us, this Berlin business and the fact that it's an ongoing problem with this hemorrhage through the two parts of Berlin. This is to our interest. It gives us increased leverage in terms of our dealings with the Western powers about West Germany. And so, therefore, one can infer from that when they, after Kennedy's July 1961 speech, and the Soviets said, no, we're not going to, risk war with these people, then they build the Berlin Wall, that change in policy on their part should be interpreted in terms of what they had said prior to that point, right? And in fact, they tell the Western powers just days before the Berlin Wall goes up, they say, no matter what happens, your rights in West Berlin are going to be maintained intact, which again is a shift from the Khrushchev policy of threatening their rights. So, if people had approached these things in a cool, analytical way, you would think that they would draw those inferences. Right? Didn't happen. Yeah.
For Eisenhower's nuclear sharing policy with Europe, I know that he wanted to give them nuclear weapons, but did West Germany ever actually get any?
De facto, yes.
So how did they end up going back to being non-nuclear? How did we get
them? We put in the PALs, the permissive action links. Remember that whole thing with all those acronyms? It was de facto control. Always, in theory, these weapons were under American custody. But the custody arrangements were designed to be a joke. basically. When people discovered how ludicrous they were, you know, how ineffective these American custody arrangements are. Basically, you have like this 18-year-old private, you know, standing in the end of a runway with a rifle. Lots of times the rifle wasn't even loaded, you know, and you'd have a German or another allied fighter bomber, you know, fully equipped with American nuclear weapons, ready to just take off, and those weapons could be used, you know, at the will of the pilot. And the sentry didn't even know what to shoot at once the engine started. You know, and people looked at this stuff and they said, oh, Eisenhower, he's so pathetic. He's this old man. He doesn't know what he's doing. You know, the military is out of control. They do all these things. Doesn't make any sense at all. It turns out our military wasn't too thrilled about all this stuff, and it was a political decision on the top, and they deliberately had this kind of sham custody arrangement. They used terms like token, nominal, that sort of thing, so that they could say that, oh, we're in technical compliance with the law. These weapons are under American custody. But they tell the Europeans, look, you have effective control of these weapons. We have this problem, this legal problem at home. We have to go through this charade, but you have control, right? So they had control. It was all deliberate. It was all something. When the Kennedy people withdraw from it, they it's not like they have to formally change the policy. Oh, we're bound by the Atomic Energy Act. Even Eisenhower recognized that, you know. But now, you know, we're going to adopt these measures and make it impossible, not just for the Europeans, but even for American military officers in Europe to use nuclear weapons without getting the codes. And the codes would only be released following a political decision in Washington. That's the meaning of the permissive action links, the PALs, as they were called. Okay? All right, so there's this... There's this attempt to kind of reach a broader understanding. All of these issues relating to Berlin, to the status quo in Europe, the German nuclear weapons and so on, they are talked about, especially at this at these meetings in Moscow. They're linked because they're all talked about practically in the same breath. Juxtaposed in the discussions, juxtaposed in the documents, especially that March of 1962 principles document that I mentioned, where the Americans basically laid out their thinking for a settlement. Right. So you have an objective linkage and also linkage resulting from the fact that in these discussions, the issues are in effect linked. They're kind of talked about in a way that suggested that that everything was part of a package. All right, so that's the heart of the system, these understandings. And that wasn't all there was to the system, because it was rounded out. I mean, last time, kind of at the end of the lecture, I mentioned about the linkage between Cuba and Berlin. Cuba as a Soviet dependency within the American sphere, and Berlin, West Berlin, as an American dependency within the Soviet sphere. There's a certain symmetry there. You move against Berlin, nothing we can do about that, but we'll move against Cuba, and vice versa. The existence of that parallelism is part of the reason why there's a certain ambivalence on the part of the United States about Castro, you know? Maybe it's not so bad from our point of view that the Soviets have these ties with Cuba. Because just as Berlin is an Achilles heel for us, and our presence there makes it very easy for the Soviets to exert pressure on us, so their ties with Cuba have exactly the opposite effect. These two things neutralize each other as sources of tension. So maybe we should keep You understand, this is counterintuitive. When you start thinking in power political terms like that, it runs against the normal assumption that policy is shaped by ideology, that obviously the Americans wouldn't want this kind of communist cancer in the hemisphere, you know, obviously the American policy would be directed against Castro and so on. Not quite so straightforward is that, right? And then there's another element in the story that I really didn't get a chance to talk about, although it is quite interesting. This is the economic side of the story. After the Second World War, most people believed that the war had been the result of the Depression, and the Depression had come about in large part because of the defects of the international monetary system that were in place, that instead of international cooperation, you would have countries manipulating their currencies so as to kind of get a trade advantage over other countries, and this was just kind of poison in the system and so on. So as the war was coming to an end, they said, we don't want to do that same thing again. We want to have a much more cooperative arrangement. So kind of toward the end of the war, there was this big conference at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire, and they lay the basis for this international monetary system based on essentially fixed parities. Right? The dollar was the heart of the system, and all the other currencies, the exchange rates, were fixed in terms of their relationship to the dollar. And in principle, changes would be possible but they should be done on a cooperative basis. So that was the idea. The problem with any attempt to engage in price fixing, because exchange rates are essentially prices, they're prices of one currency in terms of another, is that it almost inevitably leads to great instabilities, right? Because you are going to have different rates of economic growth as Europe recovers from the war, different rates of inflation and so on. It's natural that the parities that would exist in a free market, which would allow the demand for a currency and the supply of that currency to be balanced, to be brought into balance, you know, just through the law of supply and demand. You're not going to have that if you attempt to fix prices. And sure enough, the Bretton Woods system, when it fully came into effect toward the end of the Eisenhower period, led directly to these balance of payments imbalances. The Americans were spending more abroad, not just to buy European, Japanese, other goods, than they were earning from sales abroad, right? That's and all these other sources of American spending, like the huge cost of maintaining this massive military establishment in Europe, the fact that American firms were, you know, buying up European firms or investing directly in Europe and so on. You know, that's another outflow of dollars. Yeah. So the United States started running these balance of payments deficits. And the amount of the deficit was of the same order of magnitude as the cost of maintaining the American military establishment in Europe. And so the American government said, we're maintaining that establishment to protect these people. And the fact that we have to spend so much money to maintain it is responsible for the weakening of the position of the dollar, the weakening of America's economic position vis-a-vis the rest of the world, the fact that we're running these balance of payments deficits. The Europeans should help us out. And they put, you know, they put a lot of pressure on the Europeans, especially on the Germans, who were most vulnerable to it because of where they stood vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, to in effect, absorb dollars, for example, by equipping the Bundeswehr with military equipment produced by the United States. It's called the offset agreements, right? But none of this stuff quite was able to kind of do the trick. And this was a big source of tension in the alliance. I should say that part of the effect of all of this was positive. Right? The system of fixed exchange rates was directly responsible for all of these problems, because without that, you wouldn't have had these deficits. Right? Payments would have been in balance. Okay? But the fact that you had this serious problem meant that the American threat to leave Europe if the Europeans didn't do what we wanted was more credible than it otherwise would have been. Because the Americans were very upset about the whole payments deficit business and the reluctance of the Europeans to kind of help us out in this whole area. When you try and understand why it was in 1963 that the that the Germans gave way. I don't know how I'm going to make it back to my office later. And why it was that the Germans gave way to these American threats. What made those threats credible was in part the fact that the Americans were quite serious about reducing their troop levels, because they viewed the balance of payments problem as so serious. All right. So 1963, what do you have? You have, following these American threats and the Germans giving way, the Germans are agreeing to absorb a large part, finance a large part of that payments deficit. And in exchange for that, they get a promise delivered by Secretary of State Dean Rusk in Frankfurt, West Germany. I think it was in October of 1963, about we're going to maintain forces in Europe of a certain size. So again, this is part and parcel of the set of arrangements that lays the basis for a stable international system, or at least one would think. And then when we fast forward to the end of the decade and the beginning of the 1970s, and we look at what went on there during the Nixon-Kissinger period, the period of détente, the great period of strategic arms control, the signing of the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty between the United States and the Soviet Union, in parallel with that, within Europe, you have this big shift in West German policy. The West Germans now say that they're willing to live with the status quo. There's a basic treaty between the West Germans and the Soviets, the Treaty of Moscow, followed by a fundamental treaty between East Germany and West Germany, laying the framework for their relations. The whole policy of the Social Democratic-led German government this period, the government of Willy Brandt, is two states and one nation. We accept, you know, the existence of the East German state. We're willing to live with them. The use of force is ruled out as an instrument of change. And this is complemented, as you would expect, given the intimate connection between the nuclear issue and the German question, by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which the Brandt government now agrees to sign. Its Christian Democratic competitors have been hostile to this. Okay, and the basic importance of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, certainly from the Soviet standpoint, was that it would keep West Germany non-nuclear. I should say, no one really cared very much about Britain and France, for example. If the spread of nuclear weapons stopped there, no one would have had any problems. People cared about Britain and France because of the implications vis-a-vis Germany. So the NPT is part of this package of agreements, and it's rounded out by something called the Quadripartite Agreement on Berlin, which basically stabilizes the status quo around West Berlin. Very odd agreement in terms of its text, because Berlin is never named in the text of the agreement itself. It's simply the area in question. Very, you know, kind of odd. So you would think, looking at everything that happened in the from 1963 to the early 1970s, that a stable system has come into being. You would think that the détente measures of the Nixon period, the Ostpolitik measures of the Brandt period, the same period. It's good because this is called in German Ostpolitik, which means Eastern policy of dramatic improvement in Germany's relations with the Soviet Union and her other East European neighbors. Okay, you would think that this is just the icing on the cake, that the basis for a stable system had been laid in the understandings that were reached, not in a treaty, informal understandings, tacit understandings often, in 1963. The icing on the cake, rounding it out. And in fact, that's what I used to think. But in fact, it turns out that things were not nearly that simple. Okay? In fact, it was not the case that this system had this kind of rock-solid stability. Right? I said the near settlement of 1963, the word near now kind of looms very large for me. It's not a full settlement. And why is it not a full settlement? Because the basic military problem had not been solved. It was not a question of American power and Soviet power balancing each other in Europe. End of story. We have this basic problem of how are you going to have extended deterrence in an era of nuclear parity? How are the American forces going to carry any political weight when the use of those forces would be suicidal? What is the solution there? Well, the normal solution would be, if extended deterrence is problematic, then you should rely on direct deterrence, which is much more solid, meaning that the Europeans should be allowed to defend themselves. It's part of the Eisenhower thinking. The Germans should be allowed to defend themselves. But if you're ruling out a German nuclear force, what's going to protect Western Europe? What's going to be the counterweight to Soviet power there? So how are you going to defend Western Europe? I mean, not with the American strategic nuclear force, because we're not going to use it if the use of that force will lead to Soviet retaliation, which would mark the end of American society. So we're not going to use it. How then would we defend Western Europe? Well, what are the possibilities? Okay. How can you do? Well, if you're not going to rely on strategic nuclear weapons, well, maybe you could rely on tactical nuclear weapons. This was possible. You know, weapons deployed on the battlefield that, you know, hit enemy troop concentrations, hit the logistical system that was supplying the enemy forces and so on. But if you do that, the other side is also going to do that. And if you're ruling out the use of nuclear weapons against the Soviet homeland and with the goal of protecting your own homeland, then you're going to basically say, well, we'll fight a nuclear war limited to the two parts of Europe. So the two parts of Europe are going to be incinerated and America and Russia are going to survive. You're going to maintain the alliance on that basis? You know, the threat that would happen, that's going to deter the Soviets? Right? So tactical nuclear weapons aren't a solution. So, oh, well, then maybe we should move away from nuclear weapons, pure and simple. Maybe we should go for a conventional defense of Europe. And again, a whole slew of problems here. You know, who are going to provide the forces? You know, the Americans already have this big balance of payments problem. They don't want to kind of deploy more forces to Europe, especially after worrying about Vietnam and so on. Who are going to provide the forces? But even if, in theory, you can build a strong conventional defense in Europe, then what's to prevent the Soviets from going nuclear and attacking Western Europe with nuclear weapons? You know, the Americans would respond in kind? Well, how would we respond? Again, attacks against the Soviet homeland? No, that's suicidal. You know, if we're not going to do that in the event of a Soviet conventional attack, because the risk is so high, what were we doing in the event of a Soviet nuclear attack? The risk would be higher still to us if we responded in kind. So, you know, no real solution to the problem of European defense. Well, this is what creates the problem, because this means there's a standing temptation on the part of the Soviets to, you know, throw their weight around. What's a source of weakness for the West is a source of strength for the Soviets. So what determines whether they're going to take advantage of this situation or not? You know? And the answer to that question turns both on an analysis of what's going on within the USSR and also on the sorts of policies that are pursued by the Western powers, which have the effect of influencing Soviet incentives one way or the other. So let me break off here, and I'll begin with that stuff next time. Hey, don't forget the time change this weekend, by the way.
I have one Sunday.